Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, July 20th, 2004. He's been called the CIA's new stooge and Iraq's new SOB. He threatens martial law. He warns he might close down sections of the media. He suggests he might delay elections. And he includes the right to impose curfews, seize assets, tap and cut telephones, crack down on groups in declared emergency zones. His defense minister warns he'll chop off insurgents' hands and heads. Alawi, the new butcher of Baghdad, a fitting symbol of imperial rule, on Taking Aim Today. Ralph?
The Newsweek article for the week of July 26th, Iraq's new SOB. Prime Minister Alawi may be no Democrat. His tough guy approach plays well for us in Baghdad, is the Newsweek column. But what's instructive is the previous week's Newsweek. The headline is, New Iraqi Prime Minister Ayad Alawi cuts off suspect's hands with axe. And the article describes the appearance of the Iraqi Prime Minister at a prison, in which the Australian newspaper The Age reported that witnesses saw Alawi shoot seven insurgents as the American bodyguards looked on, and asked by at Newsweek if he had killed anyone since taking office. Alawi chuckled. He is already flirting with dictatorship, reports Newsweek. And indeed, the dictatorship has a particular dimension. Cutting off the suspect's hands, he walked into a prison, took an axe off the wall, walked over to one of the prisoners, and literally lopped off his hand. And that was only the beginning, because indeed a seminal article in the Sydney Morning Herald by the renowned chief Herald correspondent in Baghdad, Paul McGough, described how Dr. Alawi walked into a prison with his foreign minister in tow, and he took seven young men and with his pistol shot them in the head, as a dozen Iraqi policemen and four Americans from the Prime Minister's security team watched in stunned silence.
Ralph, it was the Interior Minister, Fallah al-Nakib, who looked on and then congratulated him when the job was done.
Yes, you're quite right, Maya.
Now, the Paul McGough has been interviewed by the press in Australia because of this shocking report. Imagine a prime minister of a country executing personally six insurgents and attempting to execute seven of them. McGough is an award-winning reporter. Last year, he won the Walkley Award, the highest award for journalism in Australia, for his coverage in Iraq. And he's a former editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. And as Ralph mentioned, he's the newspaper's chief correspondent today. So he is a reliable reporter, not someone who would just off the cuff make claims such as this.
Well, it's remarkably well witnessed. He describes in detail how the Al-Ghib, the interior minister, quote, congratulated him when the job was done. And he cites the witnesses that before the killing of the prisoners, Dr. Alawi, quote, told those around him he would send a clear message to the police on how to deal with prisoners. The prisoners were against the wall, and this is a quote, we were standing in the courtyard. The interior minister said he would like to kill them on the spot. Alawi stated they deserve worse than death, pulled a pistol from his belt, and started shooting them, unquote. Reenacting the killings, a witness stood 3 to 4 meters in front of a wall and watched as Alawi swung his outstretched arm in an even arc left to right, jerking his wrist to mimic the recoil as each bullet was fired. He raised a hand to his brow, stating, each has been shot in the head. Dr. Alawi has been described by other witnesses who saw seven prisoners brought out to the courtyard as Alawi prepared to execute them. A former CIA officer, Vincent Canestraro, told a New Yorker, "If you're asking me if Alawi has blood on his hands, the answer is yes. He was a paid Mukhabarat agent for Saddam Hussein, and he was involved in many killings." Before the current shootings, the 58-year-old prime minister stated that he has told Iraqi policemen they have to have courage in their work, that he would shield them from any repercussions if they killed prisoners in the course of their duty. "I am sending a message to policemen and soldiers. Do not be scared if you kill anyone."
Now, McGough makes very clear that the reports that he had are very detailed. They were done separately. Each witness is not aware that the other spoke. They were contacted through personal channels rather than through the many political, religious, or military organizations working in Baghdad that might be trying to spin a tale. And he continues, "They've laid it out very carefully and very clearly as to what they saw." Now, the Iraqis have said, if this is true, they should come forward. And McGough replies that they were guaranteed anonymity. They were told that no identifying material would be published on them, and they told what they saw.
Maya, the press of the world has covered this story, and a particular article in the Pakistani Daily Times in Karachi, U.S. media kills story about how Iraqi Prime Minister executed six prisoners. And it goes into particular details here. "I will take you through what the witnesses have stated, and in a full chronology. They describe the surprise visit at 10:30 p.m. to the police center. The prime minister talked to policemen, toured the complex, came to a courtyard where seven prisoners were lined up against a wall, blindfolded. They were described to me as an Iraqi colloquialism for fundamentalist fighters. They had a classic look. The interior minister expressed a wish he would like to kill these men on the spot. The prime minister responded, 'They deserve worse than death.' Pulled a gun, aimed at and shot all seven. Six died, the seventh wounded in the chest." An independent corroboration in the Pakistani Daily Times.
Now, McGough has established the names of three of the prisoners who had been killed: Ahmed Abdullah Assami and Amr Lufti Mohammed Ahmed Al-Qudsiya. And the third was Walid Mehdi Ahmed Al-Samari, whose name, from the name, it would appear that he's from the Sunni Triangle from Samarra. The three names were provided to the Interior Ministry, and the senior advisor, Saba Khadum, undertook to provide a status report on each for The Age, the second Australian newspaper where McGough's article appeared. He was asked if they were prisoners, were they alive, or had they died in custody. And after a short interview, he hung up on the phone, simply saying, "I have no information. I don't want to comment on that specific matter."
Dexter Filkins in the New York Times on July 11th, in his article, "A Tough Guy Tries to Tame Baghdad," has the following account. This is an independent account. "Late one night, before taking power, Mr. Alawi was in the innards of a Baghdad prison, overseeing the interrogation of a cabal of Lebanese. No one was talking. 'Bring me an axe,' the prime minister said. Mr. Alawi lopped off the hand of one of the Lebanese men." And the article continues. This is no longer a question here of suspicion or rumor. Independent verification, detailed reports, witnesses cited, names presented, and oversight by the Interior Minister confirmed by policemen on the spot.
Well, let's look and see who is Iyad Alawi. The CIA stooge is called by Patrick Coburn, and the U.S.'s SOB in Iraq. A hard man for a tough country is what Paul McGough describes how Paul McGough describes Alawi in an article, in addition to his articles on the execution. Iyad Alawi is a neurologist, a physician who was trained in Baghdad and in Great Britain. And as a fellow physician said, his medical degree is a degree from Saddam Hussein, a Ba'ath degree. In fact, that refers to the fact that Iyad Alawi was very close to Saddam Hussein. He was his personal physician for a while when they were both young. And he was a leader in the Ba'ath Party. When he went to Europe, Iyad Alawi was in charge of the Iraqi student movement, and he served a specific role in charge of the Iraqi student movement in Great Britain. In fact, he was a spy and informed on various students, and it led to the death of some of them. Ralph?
If we look at the role of Alawi, it's essential that we understand not only that he had been a high-level intelligence operative for Saddam Hussein and carried out a number of executions and, in fact, mutilations of prisoners and those who opposed the regime of Saddam Hussein, but it goes back beyond that because Saddam Hussein had himself been installed in a CIA coup. And from the beginning of his career, whether under Saddam Hussein or in opposition to Saddam Hussein, Iyad Alawi was the CIA's man, no less, in Baghdad.
Now,
yes, ma'am.
Well, when he was president of the Iraqi Student Union in Europe, I'd like to mention that this was during the 1970s, during the rise of Saddam Hussein.
All of this, I think, has to be placed in its own and clear imperial context. That is done by Antonia Juhas in her article Foreign Policy in Focus, which deals with how the occupation of Iraq is really run by the United States and how the slaughter and the butchery of Alawi is an integral component thereof. The article deals with how the 100 orders enacted by Paul Bremer III of the Coalition Provisional Authority gave absolute control to the United States over every step taken by the putative government of Alawi in Iraq. Indeed, the implementation of the orders requires stacking every ministry with U.S.-appointed authorities with five-year terms, which is the period of the new government, which is supposed to have some nominal autonomy. But indeed, the orders are exercised pursuant to the orders that are under the control of Bremer and the United States military authorities themselves. He said, you set up these things, and they have to be pursued, and there will be no reversal of course, described Paul Bremer. Maya?
Yes, Ralph. What Paul Bremer did was assume full control by the United States over Iraq. It's an illusion of any Iraqi sovereignty. Anything goes, it is fully the United States in charge.
Order number 39 allows and requires the following: privatization of 200 state-owned enterprises, 100% ownership of foreign ownership of Iraqi business, national treatment of foreign firms, which is to say foreign firms have the same status of national companies without any restraint, unrestricted tax-free remittance of all profits and other funds to the United States, 40-year ownership licenses. U.S. corporations are to own every business, do all of the work, and send all of the money to the United States. Nothing has to be reinvested locally to service the Iraqi economy. No Iraqi need be hired. No public services guaranteed. No workers' rights insured. And corporations may remove their investments at any time. Order number 40 allows the banking sector to become a privately owned sector with all of the national banks turned over to U.S. private banks. Order 49 drops the tax rates on corporations from a previous high of 40% to a flat rate of 15%, which is rarely enforced. Order number 12, and I'm still quoting from Foreign Policy in Focus, requires a suspension of all tariffs and customs and duties and import taxes and licensing fees and surcharges on any corporate goods entering or leaving Iraq. Order 17 allows foreign contractors, including private security firms, total immunity from Iraqi law. Even if they injure a third party, kill someone, or dump toxin chemicals or poison drinking water, there can be no recourse under the Iraqi legal system. Order 77 established the Board of Supreme Audit and named its president and two deputies under a U.S. direction. Order 57 appoints an inspector within every Iraqi minister with five-year terms answerable to the U.S. military. There are approximately 200 U.S. and other international so-called advisors embedded in every Iraqi minister. The Bremer orders altered Iraq's existing laws fundamentally. And indeed, as the foreign policy article instructs us, follow the money. The United States will exert total control over Iraq and hold the strings to the largest purse in the country for the foreseeable future. The U.S. General Accounting Office reports that the CPA had spent all of Iraq's money and virtually none in anything that passes for reconstruction. The largest is approximately $24 billion of U.S. taxpayer money appropriated by Congress. The second amount, known as the Development Fund, worth about $18 billion, is money from Iraq's oil revenues, completely controlled by the United States. It spent approximately $13 billion from the fund, but it spent it on corporate infrastructure. Thus, the DFI is simply an instrument for channeling money to the corporations and then channeling their corporate profits out of the country. Control of this money shifts to John Negroponte, the new U.S. ambassador to Iraq. In addition to the largest pot of money in Iraq, Negroponte will exercise control over the largest embassy in the entire world, with over 1,500 employees in offices throughout Iraq, effectively running the country.
Ralph, the Wall Street Journal set this out on May 13, 2004. Behind the scenes, U.S. tightens grip on Iraq's future, an article by Yochi Drazen and Christopher Cooper. And it mentions, as you said before, the series of edicts that issued by Paul Bremer. In fact, he created commissions that superseded the Iraqi ministries. And as Haider al-Abadi, who runs the Iraqi Ministry of Communications, found out, the commission took responsibility for all the work that he thought he was going to be in charge of, such as licensing Iraq's television stations and sanctioning newspapers and regulating cell phone companies. But all this was transferred to the commission, whose members were selected by Washington, and there's a five-year term for the commissioners that stretches far beyond the 18-month tenure of the interim Iraqi government. And this is also true when it comes to the Ministry of Defense. Mr. Bremer had issued a lengthy edict, according to the Wall Street Journal, that consolidated control of all Iraqi troops and security forces under Ali Owawi, who is a relative of Iyad Alawi. And buried in the document is a one-paragraph emergency decree that cedes operational control of all Iraqi forces to senior U.S. military commanders in Iraq, so that Alawi is able to organize the army, make officer appointments, and set up new officer and special force courses. But the full control for combat rests solely with U.S. commanders. And in fact, the U.S. has sent Major General David Petraeus, who participated in the original Gulf War invasion, the original assault on Iraq, the current one, and he is assuming responsibility for training the new forces. He was given an extra star for his general status to make him a major general, and he is taking charge of the training. Along with Vinnell, the Vinnell company has been given a new contract recently by the Project and Contracting Office for the, that's the Iraq Project and Contracting Office. On July 13th, they issued a press release that Vinnell, the Vinnell Corporation from Fairfax, Virginia, known also for training the Saudi National Guard, the Vinnell Corporation has been selected for the Iraqi Armed Forces training support. And as you mentioned, these orders are an open door for U.S. corporations. And I went and looked at how the Coalition Provisional Authority under Paul Bremer had spent the funds. Now, these are not the funds that were really allocated by the U.S. Congress. In fact, they first spent the funds developed from the Iraqi oil money. And they have contracted so far with Bechtel for $1.8 billion. With Parsons Brinckerhoff, people will remember, a large construction firm, for $1.9 billion. For Fluor, that's the old Fluor Daniel, now Fluor International, for $1.8 billion. And for a fourth company, Washington International, for $1.1 billion. We're not talking about chicken feed here. We're talking in not hundreds of millions of dollars. We're talking about almost $2 billion each. And this is for, among things such as electrical power generation and the oil infrastructure, it also includes work on the renovation of four military bases to begin with in Iraq.
Look, the multi-billions of dollars that have been taken out of working people's sweated labor in the United States and handed over to Iraq, nominally for such purposes as reconstruction, leaving aside the question of profiteering, the New York Times describes it on June 30th, 2004 as follows. First, specifying the multi-billions of dollars that have been handed over, fewer than 140 of 2,300 projects that were supposedly being funded with this money are even underway. And there has been widespread waste, fraud, and simple theft of the bulk of the funds. Consequently, as the foreign policy report continues, in Iraq, supplies of electricity and water have disappeared. In fact, U.S. Special Envoy Brahimi said that the lack of reliable electricity and of drinking water throughout the country is in a crisis state. Villages have no access to water. Large cities receive water less than 50% of the time. There are huge outbreaks of cholera, diarrhea, nausea, kidney stones, and death. Destroyed bridges continue to create monstrous bottlenecks in all parts of the country. The overburdened hospitals lack electricity and water and sewage. In fact, raw sewage flows through the hospital corridors. The hospitals lack medicines and medical supplies. There are few projects underway that have any bearing upon the lives and necessities of the Iraqi people. In fact, U.S. contractors report that one out of every three reconstruction dollars goes into the pockets of the corporations without any reconstruction, and another one-third toward security costs, i.e. the prisons, the wholesale raids on villages, and the rest goes unspent and frequently disappears.
Well, Ralph, I'd like to go back to discuss Iyad Alawi. As even Brahimi of the United Nations had said that Paul Bremer was essentially the dictator of Iraq in choosing Alawi. Brahimi, of course, resigned from his position soon afterwards. Now, it's important to look at the connections of Iyad Alawi and the role he actually played in the current assault on Iraq, which we'll go into a little later. But first, Iyad Alawi, as we mentioned, had been the president of the Iraqi Student Organization in Europe, the Iraqi Student Union, and with that was very close to the Ba'ath Party, but he had a falling out with Saddam Hussein. But before that, as Seymour Hersh reports in The New Yorker in the June 28th edition, a Middle Eastern diplomat confirmed that Alawi was involved with the Mukhabarat, that's the Iraqi secret police, that is a hit team that killed Ba'ath Party dissenters in Europe. and no one knows the reasons that he resigned from the Ba'ath Party, but as a result, in 1978, in February of 78, he was assaulted in bed one night by an intruder in his home, where he was sleeping with his wife, and attacked with an axe. It was a brutal attack of his chest, his legs, and he was feared dead and took a year of recovery incognito in a hospital in Wales for him to recover from his injury. As a result of that, in the 1980s, he built a dissident group, a network throughout Europe, where he was traveling as a businessman and also throughout the Middle East. And by 1990, in December of 1990, he announced the formation of the WIFAC, the Iraqi National Accord, the INA, and his primary sponsors were the British, that is MI6, but he also received backing from Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United States, primarily from the CIA. By 1992, the CIA was thoroughly funding Alawi as a counterpoint, it said, to their other CIA asset, Ahmed Shalabi. And the INA was said to have links with the military inside Iraq, and also those generals and high-level Iraqi military officials who left Iraq, who defected. Ralph?
Let's look at the real complement of this structure of rapine imperial rule with a butcher as the prime minister. Secret film shows Iraqi prisoners sodomized by Charles Arthur. This is in The Independent in London on July 16th. Young male prisoners have been filmed being sodomized by American soldiers at the Adam Gribe prisoner near Baghdad. Seymour Hersh, who reported on the torture of prisoners in the New Yorker magazine, told an audience in San Francisco, "It is far worse." He said he would reveal the extent of the abuses. "I am not done reporting on all this. In fact, it's only the tip of the iceberg. Young boys were sodomized," he said, "with the cameras rolling. And the worst part is the soundtrack of the boys shrieking, 'And this is your government at war,'" unquote. Now, these literally pornographic, brutalized videos and films of young children and boys being sodomized by American soldiers have been shown in Congress, shown before the intelligence committees, and they are being sat upon. New abuse allegations surfacing against the U.S. Senate committee asks Bremer to testify. That is the Associated Press story again on July 16th. And on July 15th, Iraqi child detainees. The child talks through an open window covered by a cage-like mesh to an older boy at the Kark Juvenile Detention Facility in Baghdad. When the older boy sees a reporter, he ducks and quickly walks away. The reporter is not allowed to talk to him. Access to the multiple child detainees is difficult. Amnesty International complained it has been refused access to enter the coalition detention centers for children. In addition, the United Nations Children's Fund issued a statement raising concern over the multiple child detainees. In one location, 87 children were identified. In another, 130 were identified. Over 150 children of ages approximately 9 to 13 are held on any given day. Wael Jalil Jabbar, the warden at the detention center, told Amnesty International that families are not permitted to visit the children except on rare occasions. A group of children currently being held as security detainees. It's a generalized condition. Children are being rounded up randomly. They are being disappeared. They are being tortured. They are being sodomized. And that is only, as they say, the tip of the iceberg. Because, again, here in Associated Press, Peter Eisler and Blake Morrison, and again USA Today, more ghost detainees. The disappeared, unaccounted for.
You are listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Alawi, the new butcher of Baghdad, a fitting symbol of imperial rule. Now, to go back to...
Masa al-Khair, Ana Saad Masi. Thank you for listening to WBAI.
At 6 p.m., a report of the day's news with the WBAI news team.
Go back to Iyad Alawi and his resume, the resume that led Paul Bremer, the proconsul in Iraq for the United States, to select him as the interim prime minister and to establish so-called elections, which Alawi himself says he may delay. He may delay the elections if he sees fit, if he doesn't believe that Iraq is stable enough for elections. In other words, if he doesn't think the elections will turn out as he plans. By 1996, after 1995, one of Saddam Hussein's son-in-laws defected to Jordan. That was Hussein Kamal al-Majid. Iyad Alawi hatched the plan for a direct coup to take place in Baghdad to remove Saddam Hussein. As the Washington Post on February 1st, 2004 reports, the CIA supported the plot. The code name was DB Achilles. DB Achilles. And the CIA had added to the groups that Alawi said that he had the in Iraq, the Iraqi generals that he said were going to lead their units against Baghdad. The CIA proposed adding other Iraqi officers that were not part of the INA. And the CIA station chief in Jordan had suggested that the U.S. send air support. The Clinton administration was not ready to do that. And as a result, the military recruits inside Iraq, which the CIA asked to provide radio frequencies on which their tanks were communicating, and to show that they had, and also to put radar reflecting patches on their tanks as a sign of good faith. These were all small steps that the CIA was asking the Iraqis to take, and the Iraqis hadn't done it. So the Clinton administration, according to a report in the Washington Post by David Ignatius, he says the Clinton administration was not going to combat Saddam Hussein for this coup plan that had been hatched by Iyad Alawi, and to put all their to rely upon Iyad Alawi. And so the plan for jet cover was rejected. And as a result, the some of the INA people who had been able to be whisked out of Iraq previously were able to find safe haven. But 30 military officers inside the INA were executed, 100 more were arrested, and the lands and factories belonging to the very wealthy Alawi family, a very well-known Shiite family in Iraq, were confiscated, and even their graveyard in Najaf was demolished, supposedly to the tune of $250 million worth of assets were confiscated from the Alawi family. Now, the CIA continued to support Alawi. In 1996, he had received $6 million of covert aid just from the CIA. Now, this is the amount of money they tell you about. Remember, there all the black funds that they don't tell us about, and there had been another $5 million previously in 1995. David Wormser, in his book Tyranny's Ally, a 1999 account of the U.S.-Iraq relationship, goes into it, as well as Andrew and Patrick Coburn in their book Saddam Hussein and American Obsession, which was written in 2002. Ralph.
All of this has to be placed within a very particular context. The policy in Iraq is an imperial policy. A very significant article appeared in an interview in the Wall Street Journal with John Kerry, in which John Kerry vowed to maintain U.S. troops for years. In fact, throughout his first term and to the end of 2008, when he promised that the troops would not be in a war zone but would remain in Iraq until the end of the decade. Indeed, in the Journal, which had been the most vehement media advocate of the war in Iraq and is the chief editorial voice of the extreme right within the American political establishment, John Kerry chose the Wall Street Journal to send the U.S. ruling class, including its most far-right elements, a very clear message. Kerry set three conditions to be met for removing U.S. troops from Iraq. One, we will measure the level of stability we have achieved in the country, and we will measure the ability of security forces to preserve order in that country. And I will maintain troops there so that there will never be a failed state in Iraq, i.e. a state not under U.S. control. Indeed, Kerry virtually said, forget any double talk about democratization. And he criticized Bush again from the right. Quote, Mr. Kerry is determined to present himself as a leader of strength who will pursue the same goals but much more effectively than Mr. Bush. And indeed, he criticized Bush because he expected, quote, a precipitate withdrawal from Iraq on the part of George Bush. And he warned that Bush may be considering a, quote, too precipitate withdrawal from Iraq, which would endanger what we are seeking to achieve in Iraq. I've heard said by many people, he told the Wall Street Journal, that the White House may even withdraw some troops now in order to appease opposition to the war. I am prepared for any such political move, but we will not enter that. At the end of my first term, I will see that the troops are there and indeed doing their job. Kerry to the right of Bush. Indeed, it goes on beyond that. Kerry backs much of preemption doctrine, states Newsday on July 17th. Democratic Presidential John Kerry stated he is willing to launch a preemptive strike wherever it is required. He offered support for one of the most controversial aspects, I'm quoting from Newsday, of President Bush's national security policy as he criticized the president. Now, I am prepared as president to go and get the job done and to obtain the intelligence that we require. You bet I am, he said. Indeed, the Bush administration, which had laid out the doctrine of preemption months before the Iraqi war began in 2003, arguing that the United States can attack at will and strike first, not only had this policy endorsed by Kerry, but he went further. I will allow no country to veto what we do, and I will allow no other institution to stop what we require in order to protect our nation, which includes not only preemptive strike, but Kerry repeated his call for creating not only a director of central intelligence, but at least, quote, a doubling of spending for clandestine operations, improving interagency coordination, and accelerating control by the FBI over both foreign and domestic intelligence.
Well, Ralph, I think we should look at the word intelligence, because the basis for the dossier that was produced in Great Britain, the 196-page dossier, and that was cited by Secretary of State Colin Powell before the United Nations. The material for this dossier came from none other than Iyad Alawi. And what's interesting is the expose recently about this dossier. And the report that came out in the beginning of the year, January of 2004, when The Guardian and everyone else reported on the commission that had taken place that studied the British, the Blair government's presentation of the dossier. Spy chief regrets 45-minute Iraq weapons claim, reported Peter Frey, the European correspondent for The Age of Australia. In fact, it's the 45-minute claim that Saddam Hussein could unleash weapons of mass destruction within 45 minutes. This claim had been presented by Iyad Alawi. He said it was the work of an Iraqi military man going by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Adabak, and that he was now in hiding. In fact, as Iyad Alawi's spokesman, Nick Saros, who's the Washington representative of Alawi, and when Alawi headed the Iraqi National Accord in exile, he said that the large amount of information had been passed by the INA to MI6. And he said, quote, "We're passed it on good faith. It was for the intelligence services to verify it." But clearly, Theros later had to say to The Guardian, January 27, 2004, that it seemed to be a crock of shh. "Clearly, we have not found the WMDs," and that's a quote directly from The Guardian. Now, also, let's look at the intelligence that Iyad Alawi provided about the links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. As you know, President Bush made a lot about the links between Saddam Hussein and the al-Qaeda network. The Weekly Standard, an article by Stephen F. Hayes called "More Connections," goes into great detail about the so-called intelligence provided by Iyad Alawi, the intelligence upon which the United States and Great Britain relied for the assault on Iraq, the devastating Iraq, not only destroying the sovereignty of Iraq, but also destroying the population, the infrastructure, and creating a medical health disaster for the Iraqi people. Saddam Hussein, quote, "always had links with international terrorist organizations," end quote. Iyad Alawi had said in a CNN interview with Bill Hemmer of CNN on December 31st, 2003. He estimated that there were more than 1,000 al-Qaeda terrorists operating in Iraq. And then he said that they were not only present, quote, "they came and they were active in Iraq before the War of Liberation. They were inflicting a lot of problems, inflaming the situation in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan. They killed once about a year and a half ago 42 worshippers in the mosque in Karachi in a very ugly way," end quote. Then CIA Director George Tenet, a very close associate of Iyad Alawi, testified to the presence of al-Qaeda in Iraq. He based this upon Alawi's statements, quote, "those people have had the backing of Saddam prior to liberation, and they remained in Iraq after the collapse and after the vacuum was created. After the way they remained in Iraq, many joined since then," end quote. So here we have Iyad Alawi stating categorically that there was a distinct Saddam Hussein, Iraq, al-Qaeda connection that had been existed for many years. And in December of 2003, Alawi provided journalists with a document indicating that the September 11th hijacker, Mohammed Atta, had trained in Iraq weeks before the 9/11 hijackings. This same three-page document also claimed that Iraq had, as President Bush stated in his State of the Union address, sought uranium from Niger. Now, the report, again, was later debunked, and as we debunked on Taking Aim. But this report and all this material about the Niger, so-called uranium from Niger, about the connection between Mohammed Atta and his training in Iraq, about the al-Qaeda terrorists stationed in Iraq, this was all provided by the now Prime Minister, handpicked by Paul Bremer, Iyad Alawi. Ralph?
The lies of Alawi are the lies of imperialism. The pretexts for war are those that have long been in place for every imperial adventure. And the Kerry role in this cannot be underestimated. It is of great moment. Here is the Jerusalem Post on July 16th. Cameron Kerry, the brother of John Kerry, who has converted to Judaism recently and is a key advisor to Kerry, went to Jerusalem to meet with Ariel Sharon and to state that Bush is too soft on the Saudis and to indicate that preemptive strike in the eyes of Kerry has in mind two targets, Saudi Arabia and Iran. They're not satisfied with Iraq, and they're starting the same Alawi-like fabrication of data to provide a pretext for such strikes. Indeed, in the Jerusalem Post, It quotes Cameron Kerry as stating that the Kerry campaign is going to attack Bush for not doing enough for Israel and for not taking a sufficiently aggressive stance towards Saudi Arabia. And he said it did Kerry in a phone interview conducted on his way from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv. Bush has not been aggressive enough towards Saudi Arabia. We criticize Bush over his policies concerning Israel for not doing enough to support Israel and for not providing the wherewithal for Israel to do what is necessary in the Middle East, and that includes not being timid about challenging Saudi Arabia. They are setting up the Saudis for direct seizure of Saudi oil. Once again, too soft on the Saudis. And indeed, the House votes to block aid with full Democratic support to Saudi Arabia on July 15th. Lawmakers cheered as the House of Representatives voted to strip all financial assistance to Saudi Arabia. This is a prelude to destabilizing that regime. And indeed, Kerry's brother states Haaretz on July 14th, the brother of Democratic presidential Kerry, presidential candidate John Kerry, met Israeli leaders on Wednesday to ease any concern about the U.S. senator's commitment to the Jewish state. A principal advisor to his brother, Cameron Kerry, a Jewish convert, I quote from Haaretz, was sent as a surrogate to reassure Israelis that the Democratic candidate is a stronger supporter of Israeli plans than George Bush. He described his four-day trip as a personal visit with Ariel Sharon, an opposition leader, met Israeli leaders on Wednesday to ease any concern about the U.S. senator's commitment to the Jewish state. A principal advisor to his brother, Cameron Kerry, a Jewish convert, I quote from Haaretz, was sent as a surrogate to reassure Israelis that the Democratic candidate is a stronger supporter of Israeli plans than George Bush. He described his four-day trip as a personal visit with Ariel Sharon and opposition leader Shimon Peres. And indeed, the article makes clear that this is in a very specific context. Here is the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, as reported in the Cleveland Jewish News on July 19th. The platform finalized this week in Miami resolves to uphold the close relationship between the United States and Israel and to support Israeli plans in the region. Here is Jane's military report on July 16th. Israel plans for Iran strikes. Israel, the country that regards itself as most at risk from a nuclear-capable Iran, is poised to destroy Iran's nuclear installations. This in the context of preemptive strikes. And Reuters on July 19th, with respect to Kerry and criticisms of the war in Iraq, both Kerry and Edwards, his vice presidential candidate, attacked those who raise questions about weapons of mass destruction as a pretext for going into Iraq. Forget all that. It's unimportant. It's past. And John Kerry acknowledged that he did not even read the document authorizing Bush to go to war in Iraq before voting for it. Along with other senators, he was briefed on its contents by CIA Director George Tenet, and did not bother to read the document. It is carte blanche. The Kerry people, attacking Bush from the right, are making very clear, from the Wall Street Journal to the Jerusalem Post to Haaretz, they contemplate a protracted war in Iraq, preemptive strikes against Saudi Arabia and against Iran, seconding and sanctioning Israeli attacks on both Saudi Arabia and on Iran, as described in the Jerusalem Post and Haaretz. The Alawi standard of CIA fabricated pretext for the war in Iraq, the butcher of Baghdad providing the rationale, this is but the little beginning. And this in a very specific context. CBS on July 16th, poll finds dwindling war support. 60% of Americans state the United States should not attack another country. 56% state the war is going badly in Iraq from the United States. 62% state the war is not worth the cost. This is an overwhelming mandate from the American people. Above all, the working class in the United States is making itself abundantly clear that the Democratic Party, that John Kerry, that the War Party, catering to the Wall Street Journal, positioning itself to the right of George Bush, is preparing to betray the American people once again. And that indeed is the gravamen of the Million Worker March mobilization on October 17th in Washington, D.C., mobilizing around our own agenda, mobilizing the anti-war movement in conjunction with the workers' movement to contest the sellout of the American people by the one big property party with two names.
Well, Ralph, if we are going to discuss the Israelis and their role in Iraq, we should look again at Seymour Hersh and his article, Plan B. As June 30th approaches, Israel looks to the Kurds, because he describes what exactly Israel is doing right now in the north of Iraq to destabilize Iraq, to destabilize Turkey, and to destabilize Iran, setting the stage for the assault, the next stage, as we described many, many months ago in our program, Next Steps. And that is the breakup of Iran, Syria, and also with designs on Turkey, too. And what they are doing in the north, in Kurdistan, which the former Israeli intelligence officer described as Plan B, is to train commando units, Kurdish commando units, that can operate in the same manner and effectiveness, as Hersh writes, as Israel's most secretive Mistaravim, and they are working to do this in the north. The Kurdish-Israeli collaboration, Hersh writes, inevitably expanded. Some Israeli operatives have crossed the border into Iran, accompanied by Kurdish commandos, to install sensors and other sensitive devices that primarily target suspected Iranian nuclear facilities. If you recall, Israel attacked the Iraqi nuclear facilities, the atomic energy plant, and they are planning, as Ralph mentioned, to attack the Iranian nuclear energy plants too. So we have here again Israel setting up in Kurdistan. Ralph?
Well, Maya, the plans of the Israelis and the United States, of whom Alawi has been a primary instrument, continue to be the policy of the Democratic Party and John Kerry, and nothing so well symbolizes and expresses that as the statement that Cameron Kerry, the brother of John Kerry, made to the Jerusalem Post on July 16th, that John Kerry intends to appoint as his special envoy to the Middle East none other than James Baker. James Baker, the senior partner of Baker and Botts, the instrument of the Carlyle Group of Bush Sr., of that whole wing of the ruling class that has brought us the Carlyle Group and its financial machinations with the BCCI and its link to flight capital throughout the Arab East, linked indeed to the Zionist state's predations upon the Arab peoples and on Palestine, the forward force for U.S. imperial designs in the region. James Baker, the special envoy of John Kerry, if anything expresses the unity of the ruling class with these two parties that have really one policy, with its betrayal of the American people, with its abdication of any putative opposition to the paradigm of imperial rule throughout the world, it is this demonstration of the Democratic Party's subordination to the Bush plan. It is one plan. It is Kerry Bush. It is one unity against the interests of the population itself. The mobilization that will take place at the Democratic National Convention through the Steelworkers Union and through the mobilization that is called for by IAC and ANSWER and by anti-war groups makes clear that we have to go into a mobilization mode. The demonstrations at the Democratic National Convention and at the Republican National Convention are but the lead-up to October 17th, when the anti-war movement was joined with the workers' movement in a massive mobilization in Washington, because our people have declared themselves. We are opposed to these imperial adventures. The American people do not want these wars of predation. They do not want the butcher of Baghdad as an expression of our society's role in the world. Mobilize, brothers and sisters. That is our task. That is the gravamen of Alawi, the butcher of Baghdad. That is the meaning of the capitulation of the Democratic Party to the policies of imperialism of which they are a primary instrument.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Alawi, the new butcher of Baghdad, a fitting symbol of imperial rule. You can listen to it on our archive at www.takingaim.info. You can contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net or takingaim@wbai.org. Cassettes and CDs of our programs are also available. Next week, we have a special edition of Taking Aim during the WBAI Fun Drive. We will be on from 7 o'clock till 9:30, and we'll address the one big property party, that is the Democratic Party, as well as the Republican Party.
With a report back from the Democratic National Convention and the talks that Clarence Thomas, the co-chair of the Milling Worker March, and I will be giving at those demonstrations as we mobilize for October 17th.
We'll be with you next week.